the VCA Voice podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Marie Curl. Our goal with the VCA Voice is to showcase how VCA Animal Hospitals is taking care of the future of veterinary medicine. We'll bring our purpose to life through meaningful conversations about care, our culture, and the communities we serve. February is Dental Health Month in Veterinary Medicine, so for today's episode, I'm happy to welcome Dr. Cindy Coons and learn about her passion in dentistry. Cindy is a regional medical director for VCA Animal Hospitals in the Mountain Southwest Group. Hi, Cindy. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm so happy you're here, and I think we're going to have a great discussion. I'd like to start off with hearing a little bit about your journey in veterinary medicine and what that looked like for you.
Well, according to my cousin, I found my passion at the age of 4.
Oh, wow.
Once I found out what a veterinarian was, it's been my North Star. It's been my passion. And I feel very grateful that I've been able to pursue it, find that type of joyful career, and be able to be a veterinarian, because it is a bit of a road and a commitment. And I learned at a young age that, you know, you really want your career to be something you enjoy.
So what did school look like for you?
So I'm a resident of Nebraska originally. And so Nebraska did not have a veterinary school. And we had a very unique reciprocal agreement with Kansas State, where a small group of us was picked to go down in-state tuition. And in exchange, they'd send human dental students up to the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. So I was lucky enough to be selected for that program. So after the University of Lincoln, I went down to Kansas State and really enjoyed my time there. They really do produce veterinarians that I think are very well-rounded as far as small animal, large animal, and exotics. Mm-hmm. So very grateful for the education that I got there.
Yeah, I spent a little bit of time at K-State, and it's a great school. Mm-hmm. But Nebraska now has a vet school. Isn't it a two-year program in Lincoln and then 2 years with Iowa State, I think, now?
Correct. So it does date me a little bit. You're correct.
No, it's all good. Do they still have a reciprocal agreement, do you know, or is everything with Iowa now?
No, I don't believe it is. I think it's in place of that program. I think that that's what they ended up doing. So at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, you can actually get your bachelor's in veterinary science, biomedical science. And I was lucky enough to have such a great undergraduate experience there. I was part of the honors program, did research at the Omaha Zoo, and able to work with exotic species like that, be published. So it was a very well-rounded education before going down to Kansas State.
So you graduated from K-State, and then what happened?
Well, if I could go back and talk to my former self at that time, I was in the MASH program wanting to do an internship, and I guess I had a misunderstanding of what internships were all about. I really felt like if I did an internship, I have to go on and specialize. I just couldn't settle on one thing. Mm-hmm. And so I actually withdrew the day before the match happened and decided to go off into a GP practice in Eastern Pennsylvania, and definitely enjoyed my time out there. And I think from each GP practice that you practice at, you accumulate different experiences. And really, the one that I think I developed my best skills medically, leadership-wise, et cetera, was actually after living in Pennsylvania. I moved back after getting married to Denver, Colorado, and joined a 13-doctor practice here. And so that's where I learned emergency, laparoscopic procedures, otoscopic procedures, advanced dentistry, emergency work, you know, advanced surgery. It was definitely where I came into my own. And then shortly after, joined a VCA hospital when I started having a family and needing to slow down. And that was my favorite place that I've worked at.
So by my understanding, the 13-doctor practice that you joined became a VCA hospital while you were there, right?
It was actually after. So they became a corporation called CAPNA and acquired 3-4 years after I left. So I was not surprised that VCA picked them up. They're a high-quality hospital. They're one of our main hybrid hospitals here in Denver. And so definitely it was a welcome to have them part of the VCA family here in the Denver metro area.
Tell me when you became a regional medical director, and was it straight into that, or were you an area medical director? What did that look like?
After I wanted to kind of move out of the emergency work and wanted to be more of a solid GP doctor, I was lucky enough to find VCA Orchard here in the Denver metro area. And I mean, definitely that is where I enjoyed myself the most. I was able to, as an associate doctor, have everything that I wanted as far as medications, equipment, The regional team was so supportive. The culture of the hospital was amazing. And from there, I had an opportunity to step into a medical directorship. And then from there, I started getting recruited into regional tasks on the medical side. Really kind of loved it. So I never really stepped into this area and then regional medical role because I wanted a change. It was more of a door that opened because I loved practicing and I love my clients. It was more of a transition because of an opportunity presented itself. So I started as an area medical director, then moved into the regional role in about 2018.
What do you like best about being a regional medical director? And what are a couple of challenges with the role?
With my experience now, I mean, between private and corporate practice, I had about 14 years under my belt. And I enjoy developing other doctors. I enjoy supporting other doctors and the medical side of all the different hospitals. And so being there for them and being able to help, especially new grads, transition from academic to actual clinical practice and being able to make that experience much different maybe than some of us experienced as we were dropped into the deep end. It's very meaningful. And so being able to help them be their best self in the veterinary profession and also being able to have really productive conversations about challenges to the veterinary profession, which is probably the drawbacks that I would see with being in a regional role is sometimes, you know, being short-staffed, finding doctors. How do you figure out how to support a team when they're down staff or down appointment visits or some are struggling within the profession itself? And finding that happy place within the profession and being able to support them. Sometimes it can be difficult, but very rewarding when you find them work through those hard times and see a hospital go from struggling to thriving. Same with the doctors as well. I really enjoy seeing them go from a place of I'm trying to find my place to really thriving within the profession.
That's great. And I'm glad you called out the experience of new graduates as well. I'm thinking back to that time in my life, I was like a fish out of water going from school into practice. Very difficult. And you've developed some novel programs to develop new graduates as they join our VCA hospitals in your region. Is that right?
Yeah. So I was first part of developing VCA Academy, which was the new grad mentorship program in the past. And really, it came off of my own experiences watching others as they were transitioning from academic to private practice. And so that was very engaging for me to be able to make a difference like that on someone else's experience coming into the profession was extraordinarily rewarding. Spending the time and efforts up front to help them with that transition. Those of us who have had a mentor who has slowed down to help teach us and collaborate on cases, that helps us feel more confident in ourselves quicker and obviously do higher quality medicine. So being able to have mentorship, having hands-on labs and skills that you develop that we invest right off the bat, having some doctors who come in have not done a lot of elective surgery. So doing, you know, partnered surgery with them until they feel confident. I think that that's one of the things I'm most proud of with VCA is that they've slowed down to invest in their newer doctors. And it definitely helps pay off for them and for us.
You've mentioned dentistry a few times in what you've been talking about. And as I think about new graduates, that's actually an area in school that is not required to be a part of their education. So there are some veterinarians who graduate without that training. So that brings us nicely into what I know your other passion is, in addition to being a regional medical director, of the role of oral health and overall patient health. Tell me a little bit about that development and growth of that part of your career and your interest in oral health.
Absolutely. I won't say K-State was the one who exposed me the most. I got a lot of academic training, but not a lot of hands-on training. And I think we need to accept that that's more normal than not normal when students come out of school. And so just accepting that and then as new grads come in, provide the skills that they need is should be our focus. So for me, when I came out, the owners of that practice that I joined, where I gained so many different skills, they kind of voluntold me that we need another doctor to do dentistry. I was young and eager and low on the totem pole. And I was like, sure, let's do this. I said, as long as you know I don't know much and you'll be investing a lot of time and effort in me, I'm willing to put in the work. And I'm happy that I did, because honestly, it's the most rewarding subsection of veterinary medicine that I think that's out there. And those who learn to practice this skill well for their patients, they find it very rewarding. And I was lucky enough because one of the doctors at that practice was actually going through a residency and pursuing board certification. So we had we had boarded dentists coming in and out of the hospital all the time. So I was learning from multiple amazing mentors, got to go to many different dental forums. They're kind of like big conferences, but it's all dentistry. And so you can go to, you can go to you can go to beginner tracks. You can go to intermediate tracks. You can go to advanced tracks. I went to multiple ones of those conferences and then also attended wet labs. So worked on not only my knowledge, but my hands-on skills. And over the next maybe 1 to 2 years, that's where I felt very confident, became very confident in advanced general dentistry. But I think it's a process, and you need a mentor and you need a lot of hands-on experience as you gain those skills.
Well, and you also need a strong desire to want to learn and grow in that area. And it's not for everybody, but, you know, listening to you, I can tell that you're passionate about it and you really invested the time and energy and effort to develop expertise in that area.
Absolutely. When you can take a mouth from being diseased and painful to a healthy mouth, just being able to hear the clients tell you how their pet has changed in subtle ways they didn't even realize. They go from eating more comfortably to being more active and playful. And you just don't realize how much they cover up those symptoms of dental disease. And when you hear those things, you really feel like you've made a difference.
I'm going to guess there are some clients that are listening that may not have much knowledge of good oral health and veterinary dentistry. So tell me about some of the pillars of a good oral health program, both for pet owners and for veterinary teams, and what that looks like for dogs and cats.
Absolutely. For clients, it should very much be focused around education. Mm-hmm. So I really treated them like any other member of my veterinary team, to be honest, because it's a ground up approach as far as education goes. So you really want to start with normal anatomy and being able to go through those. And as you see things that are abnormal, you want to be able to compare and show what normal versus abnormal is. And through that education, they start to value the recommendations, and compliance will go up as well. So taking the time to really talk about the benefits of oral health care helps it become a partnership with your clients in what that journey looks like for their pet. Talking about preventative care, teeth brushing, what are proper chew toys, the Veterinary Oral Health Council, VOHC.org, has a ton of boarded dentist approved treats and toys. Things that shouldn't break teeth, but also promote strong dental health for their pets. So that's a resource I commonly shared with clients so that they could do their own education and look into things that are good for their situations. But I think also why we do regular dental cleanings and why does it involve anesthesia? I mean, all those things have to be in place, I think, to have that partnership with your client when you're developing an oral health plan.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that website, so we'll get that information from you and put it in the show notes in case anyone wants to visit
it. It's really good for veterinarians and for veterinary teams.
We're getting a new puppy, so I'll have to go and check it out.
Yes.
And see where we need to start. You mentioned preventive care. Do you brush your dog's teeth? And what do clients do if their pets just won't tolerate that for good prevention?
When we talk about preventative care, I really took an approach that I have to tailor it to the individual pet and the client. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be clients that are going to be very engaged. They're going to be looking for everything they can do. Maybe they have a compliant pet. So teeth brushing is something that probably has the highest impact on preventing periodontal disease. If you can get in with just like a little gauze on your finger or one of the little soft brushes that go on your finger or an actual approved brush that has a soft head, and you can actually mechanically kind of brush the outer surface of the teeth, you're disrupting that flat plaque before it can actually harden into tartar, which then obviously is very difficult to get off. Mm-hmm. And then using an enzymatic toothpaste that's appropriate for dogs and cats that can be swallowed actually helps break up that plaque enzymatically as well. So just getting the toothpaste on, doing whatever you can to try to brush the surface of the crowns, you're doing above and beyond. So I always gave them extra A+ report cards when they could do that.
Excellent.
But I have to say it's difficult to slow down and be able to do that as a routine every day. So there's a lot of hands-off toys and treats that actually promote dental health. They range from CET chews that actually release a mouthwash, their little fake rawhide chews that actually won't break teeth. They won't obstruct the gut.
Okay.
And they can sit and chew on it and mechanically brush their own teeth. There's diets that can do the same action. So that's where I like referencing the VOHC.org for different options and also talking to your veterinarian. They will have a lot of good recommendations as well.
Is the role of having a team with both veterinarian and technician for providing great oral care?
I think it's essential. And honestly, I really approached it as a whole team approach because from the CSR to the kennel worker, there's an opportunity to help pets achieve their best dental health. It might be a kennel worker that notices why they're boarding a dog that a tooth is broken because we've spent some time educating them on preventative care and normal abnormal anatomy. They might be the one to bring them to the doctor and say, hey, I noticed that Fluffy has a broken canine. And that gives us the opportunity to intervene a lot faster than if they came in for the routine wellness 6 months later. The CSR being able to answer general preventative health questions up front as far as dental health, knowing the products on the shelves, if they have a general question, being able to answer that, or knowing when to escalate and say, hey, that sounds like something I really would have a doctor look at from what you're describing. And then on the medical team, we would routinely have educational presentations, and we would talk about everything from periodontal disease to what does this extraction look like? Why do we do it? The value of dental x-rays. Interceptive orthodontics was one of my favorite things, is puppies. How do you ensure that their bite alignment grows in the proper fashion where it's comfortable and mechanically appropriate? So there's just a lot of things we can talk about.
Tell me, when a client brings their pet in for dental care and they admit their pet for dental prophylaxis, tell me a little bit about the steps that are involved in that.
It actually starts way before you actually drop them off for the procedure. When I see them and start talking about the value of a dental cleaning, whether I find an abnormality that's prompting me into recommending, or I'm just talking about proactive preventative health, I'm talking about that process. What does that look like? The benefits to the pet. And I want to make sure that that pet is safe for undergoing anesthesia because we really need them to be still so we can do a proper evaluation. We can do any procedures that might be required above and beyond a cleaning. We'll talk about blood work. We'll talk about potentially x-rays. It's making sure that that pet has been screened appropriately so that our anesthesia is safe and effective. So we go through that, and I really enjoy doing a lot of that up front. Because if we can screen and make sure that everything's looking good up front, we have time to have those discussions before we're under anesthesia and discuss any adjustments, additional testing, whatnot we need to do to make sure the patient's a good candidate. There's paperwork. There's always paperwork.
And always it's always making
sure that we understand that dentistry can have a range of costs, because once you get into the mouth under anesthesia, your awareness of what's going in that mouth is going to really potentially change. It could be, wow, we're doing a great job. It's just a maintenance thing, to I had no idea this was going on. I need to do my diagnostics to further look into these things and develop my recommendations. I want my clients ready as best as possible. So when I'm calling under anesthesia, we can minimize that conversation to, we've already discussed these things, but in addition, I'm seeing these things that I didn't expect. I'd even use like VCA Messenger. I would send them a photo of the x-ray and why an x-ray is important. Because if I wouldn't have had this, I wouldn't have known this was going on. And this is actually a painful tooth that I can relieve that pain today. And here's what my recommendations are. And then cost as well. If I can prepare them well up front and we have a financial plan in place, then I get the easier yes. And this is where Care Club comes in. This is where pet insurance comes in, so that we can do this comfortably, not only on the medical recommendations and feeling like we can go forward, but also on the financial side and help that client afford the care for their pet as well.
So tell me a little bit about what age dentistry should start. It may be different for dogs and cats. So routine dental cleanings, at what age those should start to try to maintain oral health and prevent future extractions and periodontal disease? And how frequently should it happen then?
Well, I definitely like to tailor it. So the recommendations are tailored per pet, and it might really depend on species, dog, cat, breed, because, you know, a Maltese, these little Malteses that come in, I think they're so cute.
They're so cute.
They're so cute. but they're notorious for having very early periodontal disease. So in those dogs, I may be recommending at 1 year of age, right away coming in, because if I can get ahead of the game and help those teeth stay healthy through routine cleanings before the disease gets under the gum line and starts eating away the bone and causing abscessation, and we have to take teeth early and things like that, that's good for the pet, that's good for the client. Whereas there's some dogs, larger breed dogs, that sometimes they can go a few years before my first cleaning. So I really like to tailor to the breed, what I'm actually seeing on the exam room, but I err always towards earlier versus later, because it's easier to maintain versus to try to backtrack once disease, especially periodontal disease, progresses. And there's always things you don't even anticipate. I've gone into dental cleanings and they have a stick stuck between their upper carnesials, or they have an oral mass that's starting to grow. It might be something cancerous. It might be something benign. Getting ahead of these things, always beneficial. So having a set of normal x-rays, really good for future dental. So being able to compare back normal to when things start to change as they get older. So I'm always on the earlier side. Cats are so unique. Whenever I have a cat on the schedule, I never know what I'm going to find. Again, earlier versus later, they're beyond periodontal disease. They also are notorious for resorptive lesions, which are like cavities in the teeth. They're not caused by sugar or improper diet or anything like that. It's a genetic predisposition. And some of those cats can lose their teeth because they're painful and parts of them are starting to degrade. And we actually will recommend extractions pretty early in life just to help keep them comfortable as we go through life. So there's cases that can be quite severe, earlier than what you're used to. And there are some cats that will go through routine cleanings throughout their whole life and not need extraction. After doing the first cleaning for dog or cat, I then will recommend future cleanings based on what I'm seeing. Sometimes they're 6 months intervals, sometimes they're a full year, but rarely beyond.
What are some signs that a client might notice of dental pain or oral pain? I've always found that as a veterinarian really challenging to be able to figure out. So how do you talk to clients about that?
Well, one thing advice-wise to all the veterinary professionals out there is if you have a pet who's not eating, be very careful. It most likely is not the teeth that are actually causing a pet to not eat altogether. We have to look for other causes of why they don't have that appetite. Pets are very much still programmed like the wild. Their job is to mask any pain or weakness that they're seeing. So they will tend to eat through it, any pain and discomfort. But you can pick up on a number of different behavioral changes that tip you off that there is something going on. Dogs or cats, sometimes when they have pain, they may shift from one side of the mouth where the trouble spot is to the other. You might notice that they're dropping food out of their mouth when they normally weren't doing that, or they're not retrieving their favorite toy or playing with their favorite toy like they normally do. All of a sudden, they're rejecting it. You might notice that, in, especially in cats, when they have these resorptive lesions, these open cavities in their teeth that develop, they actually can be kind of painful. And cats love to chatter their teeth. So as they drink cold water, they might chatter their teeth just a little bit. They're so painful. Sometimes if you touch that area, they'll chatter even under anesthesia. So changes is what I'd be looking for. I notice my clients are pretty attentive to their pets. When they tell me something's different, I've learned long ago to listen. So when they say, hey, they're just not chewing right, or there's a foul odor coming from the mouth, based on what I hear, then I tailor the recommendation.
Would cats have a change in their grooming habits from oral pain, or does that not really happen?
I wouldn't rule it out when you're talking about grooming that obviously involves the mouth. If you have a bunch of open cavities and the teeth hurt themselves, that would be uncomfortable. So I can see that when their body tells them to do things, whether it's eat or groom or whatnot, I don't think it's a classic, but it's definitely a possibility. So you want to keep that in mind. Behavioral changes in cats are also something that has been linked to oral health pain. So you have cats that sometimes don't want to be pet, or they're more reclusive. I have had behavioral reports after alleviating a painful area in a cat's mouth where all of a sudden they're more interactive, they're looking for pets, they're more friendly to strangers, where they were hiding a lot more or changing their behavior in that way or becoming more aggressive because they were just afraid you were going to touch them and it would be painful. So that's something to keep in mind along with the grooming.
So So, Cindy, I've heard about a term called awake dentistry that some people promote for pets, which sounds great to avoid anesthesia. But what are some of the issues with those procedures and why is anesthesia so important?
Well, I have to say that from having done quite a bit of dentistry, I unfortunately have encountered these cases where clients or even some veterinarians have recommended awake dentals. And after years of especially that approach, what I notice is that when I go into a professional dental under anesthesia, where you can really see what's going on, is that you might have beautiful crowns. Maybe they can get in there and they can clean the surface of the crown above the gum line, but they're never going to be able to get below the gum line. And if you think about your own dental cleanings, they go a little bit below the gum line to make sure that they're getting all that tartar off. And if you're a pet yourself, how anxiety inducing is that for someone to be scraping the surface of your teeth, trying to get under the gum line? It might be bleeding. So between the pain and fear, I don't think it's the best thing for the pet to approach it this way. Because you really need them to be very still so you can get underneath the gum line, really do a proper cleaning and evaluation. And if they've had these awake dentals, what I see is in those areas they can't reach, the dental disease has progressed. And sometimes into a severe fashion, especially on the insides of the teeth, because it's very difficult to do that awake. Yeah, so I'll see rotten teeth on the inside and some pearly whites on the other side. And unfortunately, did we really do the service we were intending towards that pet? I would argue no. And I would say, especially if you're trying to avoid cost, you're definitely going to spend more in the long run because it's not a thorough cleaning. And then anesthesia has become so safe nowadays. If we do proper screening, we do proper workups, the risk is extraordinarily low. Our medications are reversible. They relieve pain and anxiety up front before we go under anesthesia. And so they tend to tolerate it very, very well. But it's a good discussion to have with your veterinarian as to what's the proper approach.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm just curious, you mentioned Maltese earlier as an example of a breed that needed early and probably more frequent attention for dental care. What are some other breeds of dogs and cats that clients should be aware of?
I think in general, all small breeds.
Okay.
And if you have any of those, what we call brachiocephalic or smush nose breeds, you know, your bulldogs, your pugs, your Bostons, your Frenchies.
Frenchies.
Yes. They have unique challenges because the anatomy of their snout is smushed. So all their teeth get smushed together and they're functionally normal, no concerns, but they're more prone to developing disease between those teeth because of the crowding. So getting them in sooner to get in there and try to preserve as many teeth as you can for as long as possible would be my strong recommendation. So those are some breeds that I'd be focusing on in particular. And then cats, if you have a purebred, that's one of the risk factors that we see that genetically they're prone to these quote unquote cavities of the teeth at an early age. And unfortunately, we're still doing a lot of research as to why resorptive lesions occur. You know, is it diet? Is it genetics? Strong genetic component for sure. And unfortunately, the only solution, because they're dissolving and being eaten away from the inside out, you can't do a cavity filling on them. The only solution is extraction. But they're way more comfortable without their teeth than with their teeth in these cases. And they do beautifully with either wet and sometimes even hard food. They're very stubborn. So if they like to eat their hard food, they'll still eat it with no teeth. But getting in there and taking care of that earlier to keep them pain-free is a better choice. But again, you have to go case by case as to what the recommendation is.
I always found extractions to be extremely challenging as a veterinarian. What is it that makes extraction so difficult in pets?
Well, from my experience, what I would say is you have to have a great mentor because every case is a learning opportunity and everything you can learn by the book, how to do an extraction, but doing it in a real life with a real patient is very different. So having someone who can be there with you as you're doing them and starting your journey on developing these dental skills is immensely helpful. So that's when I have a new grad who's joining, I always first look who's in the hospital, who's going to be there for them, whether it be an elective surgery or whether it's a dentistry, to be able to help them if they have questions and has the skills to provide during those cases. If you're able to learn from each case as you go, your learning curve is going to be much shorter than if you struggle and try to guess and try to figure out things on your own. I like partnering that with also the hands-on labs. And there's many different amazing options throughout the country. We're lucky here in Colorado. We have multiple hands-on labs with boarded specialists. And then the Veterinary Dental Forum is something I highly recommend because it's like a conference, but really focused in on dentistry. So mm-hmm. what you're going to learn there education-wise, and if you take the lab, your skills will go up. And don't think you do it one and done. You really need to go back and continue to learn changes, updates, new techniques, because that's what's the difference between struggling with an extraction and having it nice and smooth. And if something goes sideways, like you break a root, for instance, you know how to get in and atraumatically get that root tip out, because we can't leave those behind.
Absolutely. Well, this has just been fascinating. I love hearing your passion and learning a lot from you about appropriate dental care and how you develop that skill and how our veterinarians and technicians can learn and grow in their own career path with that. So Cindy, thank you so much for joining. We're very lucky to have you as a part of the Regional Medical Director team, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening in. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider subscribing. Don't forget to leave a review to let us know your thoughts and share the episode with friends. Follow VCA Animal Hospitals on social media at LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. For more inspiring stories, visit our website at vcavoice.com.